It's a privilege and an honor to welcome you to the Epidemiology Section Awards Ceremony and the Wade Hampton Frost Lecture for 2012. We have a wonderful group of awardees this year, and I'm just delighted at our program. I do want to just share with you a few things, just a few announcements. If you haven't visited our section booth at the expo, you can pick up information about our section social, which is on Tuesday night. We also have members meetings. Our last members meeting is 7 a.m. Tuesday morning. So if you're so inclined to get up that early, please come and visit us. But I also want to just say a number of things just about our section in general. For those of you who don't know, our section, out of the 58 components of APHA, our section this year won the award for member engagement. So I take my hat off to our membership chair, Marion Passanante. Marion? And also the committee members, so thank you very much. I also, in February of this year, I had asked our my esteemed colleagues on the epidemiology section to put together a list of goals for 2012. And if you attended the business meeting, you already knew that the goals for each of those committees and chairs had been achieved this year. So, I mean, I'm so delighted with the colleagues that I work with. That's wonderful. Thank you. It's my honor to. I need my book, my blue book. It always helps if you have your remarks with you. Thank you. It's my honor to present, also to present, the 2012 John Snow Award to Dr. Roberta Ness. The recipient of this year's John Snow Award recognizes an outstanding epidemiologist for excellence in epidemiologic practice or research. The recipient will have made contributions of enduring value to the improvement of human health or substantial reduction in burden of disease, will have been responsible for innovations in public health, and in public health practice based on clear epidemiologic foundations or implementation of epidemiologic approaches to the solution of health problems. They will also have made contributions to the field which are practical, explicit, and applied rather than theoretical or implicit. I'm proud to say Dr. Roberta Ness has met all of these criteria. In her distinguished throughout her distinguished career, she's a recognized expert in women's health research. She became dean of the University of Texas School of Public Health in November of 2008. Dr. Ness also holds the M. David Lowe Chair in Public Health and is a professor in the Division of Epidemiology and Disease Control. Dr. Ness is also Vice President of Innovation for the University of Texas Health Science Center at Houston, or UT Health. She is an adjunct professor at the Department of Epidemiology at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, an adjunct professor in the Departments of Internal Medicine and Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at the University of Texas Medical School. She is a member of the Institute of Medicine and the National Academies of Science, a fellow of the American College of Physicians, and past president of the American College of Epidemiology. Dr. Ness has been at the forefront of women's health research, being one of the first to propose the research paradigm now termed, quote, gender-based biology, in her book titled Health and Disease Among Women. In 200 peer-reviewed publications and over 20 federally funded grants, Dr. Ness has explored the epidemiology of ovarian cancer, preeclampsia, and pelvic inflammatory disease. as well as adverse pregnancy and perinatal outcomes, the links between reproductive history and cardiovascular disease, and bacterial sexually transmitted infections. Dr. Ness is a frequent advisor to the National Institutes of Health and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, and the Department of Defense. She has taken part in several reports for the Institute of Medicine and of the National Academy of Science. Dr. Ness.
Thank you. I'll say just a very few words. First of all, thank you very, very much to the EPI section. I'm pretty overwhelmed. You know, the greatest accolade that a person can get is one from their own family, and so this is really very, very special to me. So I really want to say that my life has been remarkably fortunate, but I would say it's been fortunate in a very particular way that's kind of I want to spread the word about, and that is to say that I have been the recipient of tremendous mentoring and kind of learning from extraordinary colleagues and coworkers and staff. And you know, there's so many people that come to mind in thinking about the extraordinary interactions that I've had throughout my life, and I've learned from so many different people, some of whom are in this room. But I guess the thing I'd like to say about that is I think it gives all of us pause to think about how we interact with other people and how we can really be so impactful on other people's lives. All the very senior people in this room who have had a great impact on epidemiology, but really have also had an impact on younger people in our field. And so I was one of those younger people once. And again, was so incredibly fortunate to have learned so much. So thank you very much, and appreciate it.
Also joining us today for the ceremony is Dr. Phil Mackey from the John Snow Society in Britain. They're a partner with us in giving this award, and we usually have someone from that organization with us to present the award with us to our winner. The next award is the Abraham Lilienfeld Award for Teaching, and Siobhan Mady is going to do the presentation of that award.
So, good afternoon. This afternoon, I have the honor of introducing someone that I refer to as a mentor, a friend, and most important, an inspiration. So Dr. George Kaplan is the recipient of this year's Abraham Lilienfeld Award, which is the award that recognizes excellence in teaching of epidemiology during the course of a career. Lilienfeld Award winners exhibit their teaching excellence via diverse mechanisms such as effective classroom lectures, compelling professional presentations, significant and numerous, in Dr. Kaplan's case, publications of conceptual and methodologic importance, and mentorship of students who emerge to make worthwhile contributions to improve the public health. Dr. Kaplan's career is exemplary in these areas. For example, he is the Thomas Francis Collegiate Emeritus Professor of Public Health and Emeritus Professor of Epidemiology at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. He was professor and chair of the Department of Epidemiology at Michigan from 1997 to 2003. And during that time, he established the first formal doctoral program in social epidemiology in the country and founded the Center for Social Epidemiology and Population Health, or CSEP, both programs which continue to grow today. He also was the first director of the Robert Wood Johnson Health and Society Scholars Program at Michigan. And that's just Michigan. So prior to Michigan, he taught at Stanford and Berkeley. And from 1981 to 97, he was chief of the Human Population Lab of the California Department of Health Services, where he directed the Alameda County study and also initiated the Copio ischemic heart disease risk factor study. So Dr. Kaplan is a world-renowned social epidemiologist interested in how social divides become health divides, and his individual and collaborative studies have detailed the cumulative cost of socioeconomic disadvantage on health and functional outcomes in adult populations worldwide. But Dr. Kaplan is also an avid and very accomplished photographer, where he uses another sort of lens to open our eyes to view the world in a different way. And he said I could tell you his website, which is georgekaplanimages.com. So I highly recommend taking a visit there. Anyway, so Dr. Kaplan's significant art and research contributions enhance his qualifications for the award he receives today. And in the words of one of his former trainees, Dr. Susan Everson Rose, the reason Dr. Kaplan stands out as an educator and mentor are his passion for social justice, which infuses his teaching and his research, his belief that the tools of epidemiology can be used to promote a healthier and more just society, which guides his vision for social epidemiology, and his extraordinary ability to make complex ideas and concepts accessible to trainees at all levels because of the clarity in his thinking, writing, and lecturing. So these are the enviable qualities of this year's Abraham Lilienfeld Award winner, Dr. George Kaplan.
Thank you. I didn't realize that one of the benefits of getting this award was having one of your favorite students present it, former students, now accomplished in her own right. So I'll just say a few very short things. First, I want to thank the epidemiology section for this award. It's deeply appreciated, and I really think that the highest honor one can get is being honored for one's mentoring and teaching. That is a contribution to the future. And we all know that it is often painful, but it is its own reward. Of course, the secret of being a good mentor, it's all of the selection issue. That is, if you select the right people to teach and mentor, you're in this enviable position of getting back much more than you give. And that is just desserts. That is just fine. I do want to say that I think, unfortunately, in mentoring and teaching in epidemiology, we often tend to get focused on professionalism and methods and neglect what perhaps is the biggest jewel that our students and colleagues bring to us, which is their passion to make the world a healthier and more just place. And if we forget that, I know some of us do sometime in the midst of the crush of all the, you know, how are they going to learn marginal structural models? Not for me. But in the crush of trying to teach what we think they need to know, we neglect the fact that they come with this incredible treasure, which is a desire to improve the world. And that makes teaching and mentoring all the more worthwhile. Thank you.
While we're in the midst of these other awards, I would like to call your attention also to the winner of our Student Abstract Award for this year, who's listed in the box inside your program. If you see Kelly Bauer, please give her our congratulations as well, that she has won out in an enormous field of student abstracts that we had to work with this year. And in that context, I would also like to thank all those who participated in the section in helping to sort out all of the award decisions for this year. There were a lot of people who spent a lot of their valuable free time looking through CVs and abstracts and a variety of other materials to come up with what we have to give you today. The third award that we have today is, we have to ask your indulgence a little bit. The winner is not here, and the normal presenter is not here either, largely because of weather conditions. The winner is an office of the New York State Department of Public Health, and they're otherwise occupied today, tomorrow, and Wednesday. And so the winner was unable to come to be with us, but he has sent as his second one of his colleagues who is more than adequate to receive the award for him. I'll tell you just a little bit about the award because, as I said, I am not the normal presenter. Do you have it? Oh, he's even larger than what I have on the telephone, probably. Lovely and talented Jim Gaudino instead of me.
Thanks, Paul. Greetings from our fearless leader of the APHA EPI Section Public Health Practice Award Committee. And as Hal said, I'm Dr. Jim Gaudino, the past chair of the section. And I will read Dr. Fenney's great comments. And tell you a little bit about the award as well as the accomplishments of the winner of the award. The Public Health Practice Award has been designed by the EPI section to recognize the use of epidemiologic methods in an innovative and creative public health program or project. And it also, we also have a second award that has to do with individuals who are within 10 years of their terminal degree. This year, we're not giving that award. We're giving an award to recognize the body of work by a public health agency. This is an important award that gives the epidemiology section a chance to recognize the significant accomplishments of a person or program with respect to the practice of public health grounded in epidemiologic tradition and soundness. The committee received many strong applications this year, and it was really difficult to arrive at a decision because of the competition was so keen. But this year's Public Health Practice Award for an organization goes to the New York State Department of Health Perinatal and HIV Prevention Group. Let me tell you a little bit about what they were able to accomplish. In 2010, near elimination of mother-to-child transmission of HIV in New York State was achieved with a statewide mother-to-child transmission rate of 0.7%. Two decades earlier, the New York State led the nation in mother-to-child transmission of HIV with approximately 500 infants infected annually. This dramatic decrease is largely due to efforts of the Department of Health Perinatal HIV prevention team. In the late 1980s, and that goes back for me in my career as well, an unlinked study of newborn screening heel stick specimens showed a high prevalence of HIV in childbearing women. Using these data, the Department of Health began a series of efforts, including the development of clinical recommendations and guidelines for HIV screening and care of pregnant women. And in 1997, testing for HIV antibodies was added to the state's newborn screening program, allowing intensive surveillance, care monitoring, and follow-up of HIV-infected pregnant women and their exposed infants. Today, the results from newborn screening continue to play a pivotal role in the identification of HIV-exposed births and opportunities for programmatic and policy interventions. For these efforts, we wish to present the New York State Department of Health Perinatal HIV Prevention Team with this award, and I'll call up our recipient who will bring back the award to the New York State people. And you're Dr. Phil
Nasca.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Congratulations. Okay. So I thought you were going to tell the story of when I was headed to China, and so I didn't have a passport, and so Hal was helping me out with that and did a great job with the data analysis while I was gone. He's amazing, amazing. Our students are amazing, so thank you very much. All right, so I'm the one that gets to talk for 30 minutes. Many of you could provide this lecture, so I'm going to provide what is my story in this field. Each of you have your own story, so you're going to bear with me on my story. But it is one, I hope, of hope. And so I have titled this, The Roles of Epidemiology in Preventing Violence Against Women. Now, when I'm talking about violence against women, I really mean violence that occurs in a situation in which there's abuse of power and control. That can happen in same-sex as well as opposite-sex relationships. So if you don't remember anything else, epidemiology can bring hope is the message that I'm trying to impart today. So like my compadres here, I need to give thanks, and I'm going to give thanks to particularly my mentors, and I'm going to name three. From the University of North Carolina, that is Drs. Meg McCann, Barbara Helka, and Judith Fortney. I greatly appreciate everything that they passed on to me, and I'm also very thankful for a range of different students who are my continuing education team. I learned a lot from my students, and many of you guys are here, so thanks for coming. Also need to pass on a thanks to my support team, that would be friends and collaborators as well as family, and also for the work that we do in population-based science. The most important persons in our work are our study participants, because without them, change couldn't happen. New knowledge doesn't exist without our participants. So I also, of course, want to say I am so glad to be home here among lots of public health and epidemiologists. It's a great place to be, back in San Francisco and back among the public health community. All righty. I also want to say I want to dedicate this lecture to Marilyn Vine, who was a fellow student at the University of North Carolina who died from ovarian cancer much too early. We had great conversations. In fact, the hope theme actually comes from a lot of our conversations in terms of the methodology of public health and epidemiology and how that can infuse what we do with it in our careers. She was an amazing analytic talent, but even more fun is she was a terrific playwright and stage manager and producer of lots of skits, and she was definitely a leader, and I'm really grateful to her. And this is a picture of Marilyn hard at work in one of her projects. So just want to pass on thanks and thanks particularly to Marilyn for being here. All righty, how in the world does one prevent violence against women? That's a question that I have certainly been asking myself over some length of time. And I'm actually going to kind of go through the steps that I see have happened. And this is not my work, it's our collective work along these lines, and it's still going on, let me make that clear. So first was to really reframe violence as a public health issue. You'll see there's actually now monographs on this topic, but I will tell you that I did not see, when I was sitting, Vic, in your class, I did not see violence as a public health issue. I had to be educated. And in fact, I think many of us did in that way, because really violence was in the purview of criminal justice. Okay, so there was some work needing to be done there. There was also a lot of work that needed to be done in terms of defining and measuring epidemiology, and this is what we, of course, love in terms of the definition and measurement. So a lot of work has gone into that, and I'll give you a little bit of history there. And then what I'm really interested in and having a lot of fun with more recently is actually the prevention intervention work. So that, as you know, in public health, can span a whole range of work in terms of tertiary, secondary, and with primary prevention of efforts for intimate partner violence or interpersonal violence. So the bottom line here, remember nothing else except this statement, this is all you have to remember, I guess, is epidemiology, and that is the science of public health, brings hope for realizing. Here I've inserted violence prevention, but you can use it in any way that works for your career. Alrighty. So I will say for me personally that I think epidemiologists are really fortunate to see the impact of their work, and in my situation and many people's here, to see the direct impact of our work in preventing disease. I started out as a cancer epidemiologist, and actually my dissertation was on whether or not HPV was an etiologic agent in cervical cancer. Guess what? That's solved. And in fact, not only is it solved, but we have gone through vaccine efficacy trials, and now we're trying to get those vaccines in large coverage locations across the United States as well as Eastern Kentucky, which is where I am now. So that's a very short period of time, even though Hal thinks it's a longer period of time. It is about 20 years, about 25 actually, but it is a fairly short period of time. The previous award winner talked about the HIV/AIDS epidemic. That really was documented here in San Francisco. And we've gone from not even knowing the cause of AIDS, not even being able to describe it, all the way through AIDS being a chronic disease. Now, that doesn't give you hope. I mean, we definitely need a vaccine, but a lot of great success stories. And so I would say back to Marilyn, because we've had conversations, even though she's not physically here, along the lines of the importance of the gift that we have in terms of our methodology in a range of different aspects. All right, so I will also say, since I sort of struggled with my own avocation, that for me, epidemiology is really the perfect combination of mind and heart. It is the social work of public health. Alrighty, so I'm really going to provide you with something other than general inspiration, but go through what I have seen in terms of the evolution of violence becoming a public health problem and hopefully something that I don't ever have to talk about again, that is prevention. So first we had to reframe violence as a public health issue, and as I mentioned, there have been actually several. This is a monograph that was recently published in 2009, and the authors are individuals who their entire career has been at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. This was published by Linda Dalberg and Jim Mercy. Jim Mercy recently received the Public Health Hero for his work in terms of reframing violence as a public health issue. So a lot of work has been done just really in advocacy in terms of reframing that. All right, next big event is, all right, we've moved violence in the public health sphere. Now we need to do a lot of work in terms of measurement, and that's, of course, what we as epidemiologists do a lot of work in. Now get this, this is a picture of Linda Saltzman, who was a criminologist, I almost said epidemiologist, but not all people who work in epidemiology are epidemiologists. So those same skill sets that people learn in other disciplines are really helpful. And Linda died a number of years ago, another early death. She was amazing in her ability to very meticulously define things. And so she defined for us really a continuum of intimate partner violence, which includes dating violence, also stalking, and in addition, a range of different types of sexual violence. So a lot of important work comes out of CDC's and is a point to make, and particularly a debt of gratitude to Dr. Linda Saltzman. This is a depiction that is my doing entirely. Okay, just make that clear, it's not CDC. And what this is showing is really what I'm calling a continuum of interpersonal violence. And by that I mean we know that a lot of violence exposure, meaning either victimization, you experience violence, or perpetration, you do that violence, co-occurs. So for example, on your left, the bullying at the bottom of that arching arrow, bullying occurs in younger individuals who may have experienced child abuse in their family of origin or may not. Those individuals, as they age, and particularly are middle school or high school, are much more likely to sexually harass others. Those individuals are more likely to be violent toward a dating partner or same-sex partner. And then stalking frequently co-occurs after an intimate relationship that is perhaps not ended well for one party or the other. And then sexual violence can also co-occur. The only reason to give you this is to let you know that a lot of violence does co-occur, and each of those points on the arrow require detailed definitions, detailed measures. And what is the source of measurement? We are relying on individuals to tell us what they have experienced, because we know that there's significant underreporting from police data. Police data was all the data we had until very recently, and hopefully that will be the next slide. It is. Okay, so the individuals at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and many others have been instrumental in developing population-based surveys. So we have better data in terms of measurement of intimate partner violence and sexual violence. And the recent National Intimate Partner and Sexual Violence is an example of this. This is a population-based survey of 16,000 men and women. It's victimization of intimate partner violence as well as sexual violence. And so what I will do next is provide you a little bit of information about the frequency that this occurs. I'm only doing this in terms of a descriptive epidemiology lesson, okay? If you don't remember anything else on this slide, remember what's in pink and in blue to give you some idea of the frequency of violence. That is, about 1 in 4 women are raped or physically assaulted by a partner, and 1 in 10 men are either raped or physically assaulted by a partner. So this is a fairly frequent event. I'm also providing here what we would call prevalence, that is lifetime violence, severe physical, and at the top half of the slide and the bottom half is attempted or completed rape. A lot of the work that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have done is to provide definitions. Definitions mean the questions that go with that. There also is on the slide something that says NVAW. That was the first version of this population-based survey identifying the frequency of intimate partner violence. So in terms of descriptive epidemiology, this occurs frequently. The other component that we need to have some handle on is, well, does it matter? What's the impact? It's got high frequency, particularly if we're talking about lifetime experience. And so some economists used the data from the 1996 survey and estimated the cost. And the annual cost of intimate partner violence is $6 billion with a B. Dollars, okay, $6 billion. About 4% of that is medical or mental health services that are provided to victims, $1 billion lost productivity to women, and another $1 billion is really lost earnings from individuals who are murdered by their partners. None of these estimates include the criminal justice component, okay? So it's a very expensive endeavor. Odd thing to say. All right, so the other part that I wanted to talk about just briefly, and there have been lots and lots and lots and lots of papers written on this, is the health consequences or the health impact of intimate partner violence. This slide is just to give me a pause to say these are a couple of examples. There are many, many more, but we do know that intimate partner violence occurs frequently and has health impact. The next slide provides actually from the National Intimate and Sexual Violence Report, CDC report, that's 2010. And what's unique about this is that they're providing estimates of the frequency of intimate partner violence and associated outcomes for men and women. Previous studies looked only at women, and more recently we're looking at men. As you can see, everybody in this room, I can be guaranteed, knows what a p-value is, right? So we can see quickly from this slide that the same health impact that we observe in women, we also observe in men. And that's the new piece this slide provides. Okay. Bottom line then is that violence does have impact for female victims as well as male victims. We have no data, for those students in the audience, we have no data as to the health impact of intimate partner violence on perpetrators. It's a hard one to get funded, but it does have health effects. Okay. So this is a slide that is provided to let you know that many people are looking at why intimate partner violence has health effects. Okay, I'm going to ask you to trust me that there's a lot of work that's been that has gone on in terms of developing this model. But I will say that we know that intimate partner violence and sexual violence commonly occurs and is associated with a range of health outcomes. And I will argue that it really doesn't matter how it does. We still need to prevent partner violence, intimate partner violence, and sexual assault. Okay. But I'd be happy to have a conversation about that later. So, enough said, which is a Texas phrase, I believe, and that violence against women, and I'm defining it here, that is intimate partner violence, sexual violence, stalking, and psychological abuse, including verbal as well as abusive control, frequently occurs, is associated with a range of negative health outcomes, and has significant costs to individuals and to society. So now we're moving toward prevention, and as you know, the levels of prevention, so I'm not going to go over them with you, but I'm going to start at the end, if you will, in terms of tertiary prevention. So most of that work has been done in criminal justice populations, so I'll share with you a couple of examples. This is some research that was done by criminologists and psychologists, not epidemiologists, and it was conducted in the setting of a battered women's shelter. So to be eligible for this study, and it was a fairly small, but a clinical trial, they were looking at women who were leaving shelter, and they were randomized into two different groups. One, they had to be in the shelter for one day. And they were then, and the subtitle of the study was What a Difference a Day Makes, which I thought was a great title. So we're basically comparing those two individuals. And one group, those randomized to the intervention, and the intervention is 4 to 6 hours per week over 10 weeks, and it's skill-based in terms of communications and other kinds of advocacy. Compared to usual care, they did not receive that as they were leaving the shelter, and then those individuals are followed forward in time. What did they find? Over follow-up, less violence and less reabuse or reoccurrence of violence in those that received the intervention. The intervention group reported more, and I have this in quotes, effective violence, ending violence relationships. That's really important because the riskiest time for women who are leaving relationships is when they're leaving the relationship. Most murders happen at that point in time, so you need to do that very carefully with lots of support. This study, though, did find no difference. It was a fairly small, probably underpowered study, but didn't find differences in depression or psychological abuse over time. All right. Another study conducted by a friend and colleague, Judy McFarlane, not an epidemiologist, but definitely received her public health training, and actually at one of my alma maters, the University of Texas, she's a graduate, she did a study, and I just love this study because it's a really unique setting. These are women who are attempting to get emergency protective orders. So she's working with the district attorney's office in Houston, recruiting the women as they are seeking a protective order. And then the intervention, this was a small trial, intervention was focused on safety behaviors. So she's randomizing individuals to receive either the safe training on safety behaviors, and that was 6 telephone calls with advocacy therapy. Surrounding topic, though, was focused on safety. And what they found over follow-up, and follow-up occurred at 3, 6, 12, and 18 months, more safety behaviors in those individuals who received those 6 telephone calls versus those that they did not. So that's the quick overview. There's a lot of other research, but I'm just trying to give you an example here. Alrighty, so now we're moving fast, actually, to secondary prevention, and much of that work, at least in the field of violence prevention or interpersonal violence prevention, is clinic-based. And there's a lot happening right now in this area. So these are all studies that have been conducted in a range of different clinics. So let me give you a heads up on this. So actually, this year, in June of 2012, the U.S. Preventive Task Force went back and did a systematic review of all the papers that have been published on screening, and actually they've broadened it, screening as well as efforts to reduce violence in terms of counseling, many of what I've just reviewed. And what they found, again, was there's no data to absolutely show that screening alone improves outcomes for women, but bottom of the slide said 14 of the studies indicated that really none of those studies showed a negative effect of screening. So screening does no harm. That's really important. Okay. The first bullet item that I have here, or it's actually not bulleted, but it's a large, and these are not my words, fair quality randomized clinical trial. That's saved for the next slide because I'll give you a little bit more detail on that. But there are 5 studies that show fair to good quality screening instruments. Just a little bit ago, I talked about methodology in terms of developing those screening tools. There are at least 5 screening tools that have high sensitivity and high specificity. So we got the measures that we need to do a good job in screening. There are also at least 4 studies that show that interventions that have been evaluated with a randomized trial, most of them, do have some efficacy. So hope here. Alrighty. So I wanted to really quickly talk to you about Harriet McMillan's study. This was published in JAMA in 2009. It is the largest clinical trial of this type. This was conducted in 26 emergency departments, family practice units, OBGYN clinics, all in Ontario, Canada. Very large study. They screened over 6,700 women, and these were between the ages of 18 and 64, and this was done in the mid 2000s, 2005 to 2006. The women were randomized to either receive the screening, and the screening tool they used was the women's abuse screening. They received the screening by nurses before their visit, and that information was then to go to a clinician, their physician. Okay, that's the intervention. The comparison group received the same screening at the end of the visit. Okay, so the difference between everybody is screened, but the difference was the people who were screened before had the opportunities for the physician to take that information and then counsel. Okay, there has been a lot written on this topic, and it is likely that the intervention did not happen as one would like. Let me just put it that way. However, let me cut to the chase and tell you this is a follow-up study. People were followed for up to 18 months. They did lose a number of people. They really did have a high follow-up rate. It is very difficult. I will tell you from experience, it is very difficult to follow women who are in abused relationships. Okay, so the loss of follow-up rate was 43% in those that were screened before, and 41% in those who were screened afterwards. Okay, they did not find a statistically significant difference in the abuse recurrence rate, which was their primary measure of efficacy, in those that were screened versus those that were unscreened or screened afterwards. However, the difference was fairly large, 46% compared to 56%. They did not find any difference in quality of life. Importantly for our review here, though, is those women who were screened did not report harm to screening. So in terms of the no harm, important to think about. All right, this is a direct experience that I have had very recently at the University of Kentucky. In fact, when I came to the University of Kentucky, which happened in 2008, Roberta and I kind of not traded places, but we crossed in the air. So we were just implementing an electronic medical record. And I'm in an OBG, a very clinical OBGYN department. And so I was like, wow, this is a great opportunity to find out if screening, and this is in everyone is getting screened. They have to get screened to move forward in the electronic medical record. So we did not the best design, I will say, but it was the best that we could do at that point in time, and that is a retrospective cohort. So we're comparing the experience of women who were screened using the electronic medical record relative to women who received care, same clinic, very little difference in terms of the demographics of those two. So it is a retrospective in that perspective. Okay, it's about 800, almost 900 women that were included in this study. I'm going to cut to the chase and say that we would hypothesize that those women who were screened, and they're screened for not just intimate partner violence, but a whole range of psychosocial factors, including depression. Those women who received screening actually had slightly larger babies, not statistically significant, however. They had longer gestational age, in other words, less preterm. They had the babies had higher Apgar scores, and the mom experienced fewer maternal complications. Now, many physicians I'm not saying many physicians in this room, but many of physicians in my department do ask, well, why? And it is important to know why. But since I'm in a public health audience, we're not going to go there. So there is some evidence that interventions do work. So what's the impact of public health research? And I'm not just saying here in this example, but in general. And I will say, things do change. Things do change. And this particular example with regard to screening is one. The change that's very recently happened is the National Institute of Medicine had a report in July of 2011, and there were many recommendations in terms of clinical preventive services of women. One of them was recommending screening and counseling for intimate partner or interpersonal or domestic violence. That screening is part of good health care. It's only a recommendation. Now, the Affordable Care Act now requires health insurers provide prevention-related services, and there are many prevention-related services. Domestic and interpersonal violence screening and counseling is one of those. So change does happen. Now, the third element of prevention, and this is an area that many colleagues are working on, but I have a fun story of one of the things, a couple of projects that we're working on. How am I doing time-wise? Okay, alrighty, good. I grew up in Alabama, however, I can speak rapidly. My mom was a speech therapist, she helped me there. Okay, So primary prevention, which is basically either universal or risk-based intervention. I'm going to give you actually more examples in this category because I think this is really where the hope is. I will say when I first started in this, I worked at a battered women's shelter in Houston, and it can be depressing. And Claudia remembers way back in the day too when I first started, because we didn't want to be busy. We wanted everybody else to be busy, but we didn't want the battered women's shelter to be busy. So it gives me a lot of hope actually to be able to give this talk, because change is possible. Change is possible. So I have a lot of hope right now in terms of the potential for all of us to keep each other safe. That's what we tell the people in the high school, so you'll hear about that in just a second. All right, so this is some work, another Canadian, another non-epidemiologist weighing in here. This is David Wolf, and he's doing some work in a younger population. This is another clinical trial, and he's working with individuals who are at high risk. These are individuals who are in the Canadian system because they have been abused. So they are child maltreatment individuals, and they are randomized to a prevention intervention, small trial of 158 individuals, and then the comparison group are those that do not receive this treatment group, the treatment. And the treatment is an education intervention for defining healthy and defining abusive relationships. They learned conflict resolution skills, as well as effective communication skills, and then there are also some social action activities that go into this. It's a fairly long intervention. Those individuals that were then followed forward in time, and I'm going to cut to the chase and tell you that they found over time, comparing the intervention relative to the non-intervention population, that a reduction then in the intervention group in terms of physical abuse as well as emotional abuse. In those receiving the intervention relative to the comparison group, the effect of the prevention effect was actually stronger in girls relative to boys, which I thought was interesting. So that's one example, and that's in a high-risk population. Now we move to a primary prevention intervention. This was done in North Carolina, and actually this is another Dr. Schoenbach's students. This is Vanji Foshi. We were actually in school together, and neither of us had an idea we were interested in this. So she did the Safe Days program, great program, is designed for middle school and high school populations, and in this trial, which is another intervention, randomized intervention, comparing those individuals who got Safe Days curriculum relative to schools of individuals who did not, and what she found over time is that there was a difference or a change in psychological, physical, and sexual dating violence perpetration, and a reduction in moderate physical dating violence victimization. So the intervention resulted in violence reduction. One could read that as prevention. The other important thing in terms of that model that I showed you earlier is when you looked at the mediational effects, the reduction in violence actually happened in those individuals who had changes in the intervening elements that were hypothesized. So the mediation is important in terms of the analysis. Also happy to report that this very large national trial is going on now, funded by CDC, is using Safe Dates and now the Safe Dates Plus to evaluate that intervention in very large studies. Okay, so next steps, the last steps that you guys are going to experience here for me, which is looking at the role of bystander. Let me give you a little background on this. Bystanders are individuals, typically, we have a definitional problem, I'll say. Typically, bystander is a person who does nothing. So we're actually reframing that bystander to be someone who learns how to do something. We are empowering that individual not just to observe, but to do something. So there is action in that word. All right, so I want to also give a shout out to Vicki Banyard, who's at the University of New Hampshire, and their colleagues, because they brought the bystander intervention to sexual violence and dating violence. So we're actually conducting similar studies right now. And you may ask yourself, why is she putting the map of Kentucky up? Well, you may not even know this is Kentucky, but it is Kentucky. Now you may also ask yourself, as the slide does, what is a green dot? Well, a green dot, and if you look carefully, it looks like they're little hurricanes. I noticed that earlier. Okay, so this was actually designed by a psychologist, but she was informed by public health. I just love hearing her do this talk. This is my friend Dorothy Edwards. And the idea is, just as an infection can spread in a community, okay, you can actually have, and that's the red dots. The red dots are sexual violence or dating violence all across Kentucky. Kentucky is not unique, but this is the picture we have here. But through an infusion of behaviors like green dots, and green dots are any behavior, choice, word, action that promotes safety for everyone and communicates intolerance for violence. So it's changing that culture, okay? And we're doing this in high schools and in colleges. So then over time, the hope is that those red dots will be covered over with green dots. That's the concept. It's a lovely picture. Not quite happening just yet, but that's the idea, okay? So what we're doing, and this is kind of giving you the hierarchy of which we hope that the green dot will be infused. And so we have the program, which is it is designed to be twofold. It doesn't really matter for your consumption right now, but we're implementing it in high schools as well as colleges now. And the idea is that is infused beyond the person who gets the training, who becomes an active bystander, but to their social networks. Okay, so they're changing networks, and it's great to have these social networks that they actually physically use to do that, so that over time in communities we should see a reduction in violence. So we conducted a cross-sectional survey, and we're in the middle of actually randomized trials right now. But we did a cross-sectional study. The Green Dot program started at UK in 2007, so we have now 3 years since the beginning of the intervention at UK, and we're comparing the UK experience to two other populations. Okay, so we got an exposed and two intervention, one intervention and two control comparisons. We invited 15,000 individuals from the three different schools to participate in the survey. I will tell you, because it's kind of an amazing story of what we epidemiologists get ourselves into, we provided 15,000 letters. In each letter to the individual were two individual dollar bills. Believe it or not, there is literature to say that a $2 bill is not nearly as good as two $1 bills. And that's a lot of dollar bills, I'm telling you. So we provided all those dollar bills, and we actually had a response rate that was not great, but it was better than some others. These are individuals who are in college, and so if we could get them to the Zoomerang site, which suggests that, amazingly enough, individuals may not use their UK or their other university email address. But if we got them to get to their email address, the majority, 88%, participated. Our overall participation rate was under 50%, though. So that, of course, as epidemiologists, worries us in terms of selection bias. But you're going to have to bear with me. All right. So I'm providing, this is actually not published as yet. It's in process. But what we did was we hypothesized that those individuals who received the intervention, which in this case just means did they go to UK or not. This analysis doesn't say what they actually received. So we're comparing UK, which is the intervention, to the two other schools. They are comparable, and we're adjusting for all the differences between those in terms of the adjustment. We would hypothesize that those that got the intervention would be more likely to engage peer or actively bystanders, what we call that. We also hypothesized that individuals who got the intervention would be less accepting of violence or lower violence acceptance in those that got the intervention relative to those who did not. And we were hoping that those individuals who were in the intervention campus relative to the ones not, we would actually see lower violence victimization and perpetration. Okay. So we're looking at that whole continuum of violence that you saw earlier on that arrow slide. And here we see that actually, for the most part, what we hypothesized was true, that we saw greater engagement in the intervention, less acceptance in the intervention relative to the control, lower violence victimization rates, and that's primarily due to a reduction in stalking and reduction in sexual harassment. Okay? This is early on, and then we don't see a statistically significant difference in perpetration. However, when you look at the types, we do see a reduction in perpetration of sexual harassment in the intervention relative to the control group. So some hope along these lines. Alrighty, now the last thing I want to mention is an intervention trial that we are doing funded by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And we are in the middle of doing lots and lots of interviews. We go to 26 high schools over a 5-year period. We've been there 3 times, and we get up really early. I'm trying to recruit you here. We get up really early and go talk to lots of high school principals and lots of high school students. It's a real education, I will tell you. It actually kind of is fun. I'm looking forward to it. We do that every spring, and then we also have the panel survey, and then we also have cohort surveys as we follow individuals as they get the training. So we're in the middle of that. However, I need to stop, so I want to tell you one little story. And that is, this is our team. And this is a team of women who are rape crisis educators. And through CDC funding and the wisdom of CDC, I will say this is definitely wisdom of CDC, because they're empowering, they're training individuals to move from being advocates and providing direct, what I would call tertiary prevention, moving them into primary prevention. So all of these women, and precursors to those women, have learned how to be interventionists. Okay? And so they're the ones that are delivering this curriculum all across Kentucky. And so they're our colleagues. I've learned a lot from these individuals. I lucked into this, I tell you. I totally lucked into this in terms of being in the right place to do this evaluation. So it's great fun. And thanks. I don't know what else to say. I'm really honored to be here, and it was fun sharing this. Thank you. Huh? Oh, yeah, sure. I would be happy to take questions. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, this all sounds great.
Yeah.
But.
Yes.
Your outcomes are a self-reported answer on questionnaire.
Correct.
Once you've been told these are bad things to do and this is the right way to do it, aren't people more likely to give you the answers you want to hear than the people at the other college campuses that didn't hear what was said?
Great question. Great question. We are doing these surveys, the first of the data that I gave you, we're doing actually over several years. So I'm providing you the first year of data. So there is that learning effect. There's many studies that show that as you ask the same questions over time, and particularly with training, that those individuals may stop reporting because they're tired of being asked those questions or because they learn it's not a good thing to do, to report. So, yes?
The question is mm-hmm.
Oh, correct, yes. The other thing I should mention is that we have external data, too. So not only are we asking the kids to tell us about what's going on, which is a really important source of information, but we have information from all of the high schools, which I, of course, didn't provide any of that. And we also, through the Clery Act, have the same information available in all the high, in the colleges. So great, great question. Yes? What I mean by that is individuals who, there are many men who are in court-ordered treatment for battering. And that's actually almost too late to start looking at prevention. But there's very little information to see what are the health effects for men who are aggressive for battering. The cardiovascular literature would certainly tell you that people who are stressed and act out are much more likely to have cardiovascular events. So there's certainly data one can borrow from other areas, but in terms of what we are able to do for the certainly the prevention angle, very little work. And it's a very hard population to recruit and follow. Yes? This study is really exactly along the lines that you're describing. Because it is true, those individuals who grew up in households in which there is violence, women may be more likely to get into to relationships that are violent, and particularly the boys more likely to become violent. So yes, that is kind of that high-risk group, and that's a lot of what David Wolf's group is looking at as well. But earlier is better in terms of prevention. So a lot of the work that we're talking about now, hard to do from an IRB standpoint, let me just say. We camped out in the IRB for like 6 months to try to get, no, I'm not kidding, to try to get our IRB through. So yeah, it is a challenge. It is definitely a challenge. Yes, sir. The other group that received the CUC funding that I mentioned that we have is actually looking at exactly that question. That is certainly their hope. And we are, in addition, measuring bullying for the high school. We're measuring that as well. All schools, at least in Kentucky, and I'm sure that that's, if it's true in Kentucky, it's probably true in other locations, schools have to have a bullying prevention program. They do not have to have an evidence-based program. In fact, the real challenge is that the better programs may be harder to implement, so it may not be the ones that the principals choose. But it's a great question. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
And have you seen anything about lifetime programs that's being introduced in a number of schools by the David Lynch Foundation?
Yes. Yes.
Is that having any impact on violence that you're aware of?
Not that I'm aware. Most of what I'm doing is in an older population, but there are a lot of interventions for younger individuals, and kind of following up on the bullying question. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, but a really important question. Yes.
Yeah, hi. It's interesting that the sociologist Robert Sampson talks
right.
about collective efficacy,
mm-hmm.
and what he's describing there are process, neighborhood processes in which people take responsibility
yep.
for what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
On other things. So that suggests to me that there might be interventions that have to do with sort of seeding collective responsibility rather than individual action.
Mm-hmm.
That it gets played out individually, but really it involves a mindset that we're all in this together.
Right.
Do any of these interventions do more than just have to, so that would be a curriculum that went across.
And that's actually a lot. It's a great point. And in fact, we've added a component to the Green Dot that has exactly that. So it's part of that diffusion of the intervention through networks. So one of the things I didn't have time to talk about is that we're looking at how the program is diffused throughout networks And so it's a really complicated thing, but I'm sure you know all about this, that you're basically looking at friends and friends of friends and how that's diffused out throughout the high schools. But it's really to look at that issue. Yeah. Good point, yeah. Because there are so many different types. Yeah, I think it's really, I work with a number of physicians, and we have to relearn epidemiology at some level, because the clinical trial is their gold standard, and there are lots of questions that cannot be answered with those. And so that's a kind of a daily struggle for me in terms of working with my current students. But you're right in terms of what are the other kinds of intervention trials, and particularly the population-based intervention trials. Good point.